All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. My name is Savannah, and I am the producer for the Roxborough House Roundtables at Jefferson East Falls. Each episode is recorded and later posted on our YouTube and SoundCloud for those who were not able to make it to the live event. They are also aired on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on G-Town Radio 92.5 FM WGGT. For today's roundtable, we're talking about misinformation in the media with our hosts, Stephen Fillmore and Carolyn Sullivan, who are the founders and editors of the NW local newspaper. We will discuss the role of grassroots print journalism in combating misinformation and fostering civic engagement. We will also discuss the issues with bad faith journalism and their deceptive tactics. Before we begin, let's introduce everyone who is participating today.
I'm Steve Fillmore. I'm one of the co-founders and co-editors of the Northwest Local Newspaper. We consider ourselves to be grassroots news, which is sort of between mainstream and social media. In between those areas, you'll find what we believe is grassroots. I am a former English major at LaSalle University. Started off our newspaper as a history blog, actually documenting the history of a historic house on Indian Queen Lane in East Falls, and grew from there.
And I'm Carolyn Sullivan, and what he said.
I'm Megan Donnelly. I'm the Outreach and Engagement Librarian here at the Gutman Library.
My name is Jacob. I'm an instructional designer here at Jefferson University.
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm a second-year Law and Society major.
My name is Alex. I am a second-year Psychology major.
Evan Lang, Director of the Law and Society program.
I'm Sheldon, a second-year Law and Society major.
I'm Siani, a first-year Law and Society major.
I'm Jenna, a first-year Law and Society major.
I'm Eric, a second-year Law and Society major.
I'm Bryce, faculty in Communication and Law and Society.
I'm Ryan. I'm a fourth-year Law and Society major.
Okay. So just so everyone's on the same page, could you tell us a little bit more about grassroots print journalism?
Sure. As I say, we started with a history blog. From that history blog, we did that for a couple of years, we developed some neighborhood stories. There was a local newspaper in the area that shuttered shortly after we started this blog of ours. So we had a sort of a cache of neighborhood stories, and we thought, well, let's start printing. Let's start filling that space that the previous community newspaper had filled. And it really sparked a lot of engagement, a lot of people talking about their memories of the neighborhood, the history of the neighborhood, and then we started to get into other things, businesses, politics, development.
Right, we thought it was going to be like a, we thought it was going to be like a cute little community blog, but then the community council here started their own paper, so we're like, well, I guess we're not going to do the cute little community blog, what do we do? So we branched out into Germantown. And that's, I guess, where we really realized that, oh my gosh, information is actually a resource. It's not just something fun to be like, oh, what are my neighbors up to? But it's actually something that people need, and that there's a lot of bad information out there. And we kind of saw, well, maybe this paper product can help get information to people that may be across a digital divide. Maybe it adds more permanence. We can, there's other things that paper had we found is helpful. So we just kind of put our effort into giving people information, good, clean, nutritious information, and what we thought was a happy package, because we're competing, obviously, with social media, which has all the bells and whistles, so that explains why our newspaper doesn't really look like a newspaper, but that's also kind of the signal to readers, hey, you know, it's a little different than your average paper.
I just have a question before we get into the main topic.
Certainly.
Many years ago, your paper was really the way it was across the nation. It's all many, many, many local newspapers. That's essentially gone.
It is.
And most of the media is controlled by a very small handful of corporations. So why is it important to have local news as opposed to corporate news that we would receive?
Right. And it really is. And even that's a great point, because as these local newspapers have died, a lot of community organizations, CDCs, councils, they jump in and kind of have their newsletters and things, which are fine. It's just that they like to put a happy face on it. They like, they're selling, it's for property owners. Mm-hmm. So the people that, like the best communities will have papers because they have money, but the papers just tell them what they want to hear. And the communities that don't have news, that are lower income, tend to not have papers. So they're left out of the conversation. Or if they're in the conversation, they're not necessarily in respectfully, truthfully, with context, with history. And as gentrification keeps plowing neighborhoods and changing them, we're losing a lot of the culture. We're losing, a lot of people are getting left behind. A lot of things that we could be doing, we're not doing because we don't understand the importance of it, because these voices aren't being heard. So I think that's really where we're trying to fill in our niche here. Does that answer a question?
Yes, can I ask a point of clarification? You said CDC's, is that Community Development Corporation?
Community Development Organization.
So is that like a business improvement district?
Yes.
So this is like the businesses in a community get together and say, we want people to come
yes.
to.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we want people to come to Germantown.
Exactly.
So we're going to have a newspaper that is like, here's a new tchotchke
yeah.
story.
That's it.
Very promotion.
Yes. And you'll see the same people in the same, you know, they always go to the same businesses. You'll see, there are some of them that are still alive, and you'll, if you follow them long enough, they always talk to the same people. They always see the same businesses. It's about getting the whole, it's the neighborhood. Branding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll go back to the main information.
Oh, sure. Well, the one other point Carolyn mentioned about digital divide, which is also important, we mentioned earlier, is algorithms. There's no algorithms. So when you're reading a printed newspaper, it's basically curated by us and what our community contributors provide us. So you're getting perspectives that you might not find in other areas, and we've had people tell us, I've read a story on this one page, and I see another story on the other page, and I would never see those two stories
online. We get that all the time.
There is a certain amount of curation there, but it also has voice, and we also do resources. We do checks and things like that. We do our homework. So we have an opinion, but it's an informed opinion.
Right. Yeah. So, where was our next? Our next point was we wanted to look at some of the bad faith journalism that we might want to talk about that we are encountering in our day to day reading. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in, but I've identified. Let's see. We feel in our neighborhood we've got parachute reporting. Does everyone know what that is?
No.
That's when, Temple or Inquirer, like something happens. Like usually it's bad news.
Yeah. And then gun violence usually.
Yeah. And then they'll just like parachute drop in a journalist to just talk to everybody on the scene. And again, usually the people that are on the scene are the same people that keep coming to these things because that's their jam. So you kind of get the same stories told over and over again from the perspective of somebody who's outside the environment looking in. When they did a study of journalists in the area, and they compared like where people the journalists lived and where the articles in the paper were written about. Everybody, go figure, you write about the areas that you live in. So there, again, most journalists live in areas of upper middle income, so they're not living in these neighborhoods where you're going to encounter the guy selling the singles on the street and the people, so it's a different attitude, and people who live in the community are very sensitive to it, and they really don't like being reminded that they're in a scary neighborhood, and that's the narrative that gets broadcast. Mm-hmm. You want to pick up one?
Both sidesism obviously is something I think we're all familiar with. Omitting certain things or even adding things. We've been in a story where somebody actually added a source that wasn't part of the original event or incident, and that was a Temple reporter. So it was interesting, again, to balance the narrative. There was somebody else who was quoted who was not part of the original event or incident. So that's kind of a thing that we've seen here locally. Did you have another one? Did you want to go to
anybody else's encounter?
I just like to bring up a topic because last year I interviewed Mike from Mike Slakosh, and one from CNN. Yeah. And one of the things I brought up that he tried to get is, where do you find the balance between making money, which you need, and reporting? Because the problem is, especially with social media, is you have to get people's attention.
Yep.
And nice stories about butterflies and people doing nice things doesn't get that. Provocative stories, even not investigative, provocative headlines, which are not reflected in the actual body of the story.
Sure.
But yet you need to survive to pay the bills. So how do you do that before we even get into the misinformation? How do you do that balance being a small, you know, growing local newspaper?
Right. Well, growing is the idea. And I think it's right now, it's a labor of love. And we're doing our best to keep our head above water. We're fortunate that we get some grants here and there. There's a Illuminate the Arts grant that Councilmember Isaiah Thomas promotes, mm-hmm. and that's been a bit of a lifeline. Jefferson University is a lifeline. They always take out a back page ad, which is nice. So ads kind of pay for our publishing costs, and then the grants kind of pay for the contributors, because we make sure everybody who contributes gets paid something. Some people don't want it because they're like, oh, it's a donation. And then some people really need it, and we're happy to do that. As far as me and Steve go, mm-hmm. you know, we scrape by. We're doing the best. You wind mm-hmm. up doing a journeyman kind of thing, you know. But it's not solved yet. It's not sustainable at this point. But we're hoping that, again, like the government, somebody needs to understand that information is like a resource, like food or shelter. And we'll subsidize oil companies out the wazoo, but do we subsidize public transportation? Not so much. Do we subsidize, you know, we'll give lots of money, all these political ads are, God, millions and millions of dollars going into political ads every single election cycle. But, like, what would that mean for a small organization like us or, like, any other struggling newspaper? I mean, that would mm-hmm. just be huge. So there's money that people will put into advertising. So, yeah, we haven't figured that out yet. We're still working on it. Yeah.
How do you avoid the temptation?
What temptation?
Of putting out things that will get attention, will get you bigger circulation,
right.
that will bring in more money,
right.
but aren't exactly, not saying not true, but maybe not mm-hmm. as investigated as it should.
Exactly, more of the zazzy stuff, or why aren't mm-hmm. we hanging out with the developers and doing stuff on how their great new building's going to be awesome and who cares what happens. You know, it's the only reason we're doing this is because there's a reason to do this. So it doesn't make sense to counter that. If it's going to fail miserably, then that's good. I mean, honestly, I'm writing this as a story that's been unfolding for the last 10 years. I write about it all the time. So when this all blows up, if this all blows up, then I've got something to write about, right? Then you can see how news died and will be a wonderful example of news trying and failing, or maybe news trying and catching somewhere. Like, I don't know where this story goes, but we're still in progress. So that's also why these things are so important, to get this feedback from you guys, and it's just fantastic. So thank you again for this crowd. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that it helps in terms of distribution and with content is we partnered with WHYY. Mm-hmm. They have this news and information community exchange program, which is a group of grassroots collaborators or media producers across the city. So that also helps us get the paper out to West Philly, South Philly, yeah. other areas. And like I say, they also produce content, and that helps. You know, and they also provide a stipend and things like that for working with them.
Yeah.
They apparently are also trying to work a way right now to have us become contributors and partners with their editors, sort of like a part-time gig, if you will, to make some money that way.
Right, and also we were looking into street papers. Has anyone heard of street papers? You know, tell them about street papers? That's
street
kind
papers
of interesting.
Are,
we found that people were selling our paper in Germantown. We have this little honor box that used to be outside the room that was our office. We closed our office, but we had this. It's like graffitied and everything. We still fill paper with papers. And then someone told us the other day that, not the other day, but like a while ago, but we see them around, that they take out, they were losing papers like crazy. Like, how are they all disappearing? And someone was selling them. That's
yeah.
so cute,
it
but
says,
that's actually
it
a program.
It says free on the cover, but right. it does. It, they were selling them. And so we ran into a thing called a street paper, which is, it's a global thing. I think there's like almost 100 of them around the world.
Right.
And
they work differently.
They're based in Glasgow, Scotland, is where it started. And they basically, they all work off the same thing, is that unhoused people sort of will buy the newspaper at a steep discount, and then they keep whatever the difference is between what they
can
sell
the paper
for and what they've actually bought it for. So it's something that, and there's a whole, like, they also provide lots of support in terms of, like, content about unfair housing practices and all these sorts of things.
Right, some of them write.
Yeah, and some of them write, some are contributors as well. So that's an interesting model, and there's one in D.C. that we're going to go down and visit them, because there's only two, I believe, on the eastern seaboard.
Right,
one
right.
is D.C. and one Boston. Is Boston, I think.
But we're kind of doing that already, in that our contributors kind of help spread the papers, and that's kind of what street paper is. It's just a little different. And we probably wouldn't charge unhoused people to sell it, to set, give out our papers or sell them, but we might put like a QR code on it. You can pay what you wish kind of thing if you wanted to contribute for the call. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But that's...
And the whole thing about the what's Zazzy is like, it's since we're not a digital media first product, we're not really chasing engagement in that way. I mean, I don't want that to sound disingenuous, but... That's not our first concern. We're trying to get, and Carolyn does a lot of the writing and makes it very catchy, and it's got a voice to it, and I think people respond to that. And the other thing is we do a lot of, as you see on the covers, we have art, we do a lot of photos. We try to make it visually appealing so that if you're reading it, especially if you don't have a very high reading level, if you're in a lower income area,
or some people are disabled,
you might be able to
whatever.
See the photos and follow along a little bit with it. So we try to make it visually appealing as well.
So it's getting some disinformation
yes.
we're talking about.
Yeah.
In one of our classes, we deal with weapons of mass destruction and how the media do not cover that yeah. and the pressures and mm-hmm. of covering such a story. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in your point of view on what have you seen in misinformation that has been significant in the media, as people in the media?
Well, we had a story, and this is also part of being a local news organization and having a very tight focus on a certain region or area, is there was a guy who came up to us. He was a regular down at
Franklin's,
down in East Falls, a bar. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. But he found a flyer about an anti-vax flyer. So this is 2022, and it had pictures of, they had doctored photos of black and white water fountains from back in the day, which I thought was pretty crazy. But anyway, he said, hey, these guys are passing these flyers out. So we actually got those, and we also noticed they were on Nextdoor as well. So we got the information from him, we started tracking it down online, we found it goes back to a group that involved, was it Rand Paul? Who's his dad?
Oh.
Ron Paul. Ron Paul.
Right.
Ron Paul is behind it, a couple other guys. So I think it's called the Mises, M-I-S-E-S organization.
Mm-hmm.
So here they were in East Falls, and it was basically the flyer said, don't tread on Philly, but this is an AstroTurf organization, basically. So that was something that I thought was pretty interesting.
Right.
And we wrote about that. We provide information and QR codes about how to look up some of the
pictures
stuff.
Pictures of the guys that
pictures
you're actually behind it.
Yeah, and the top 12 vax information, 65% of it vax information online comes from 12 people.
Right.
So we put their photos up and their names as well.
Right.
So trying to inform people.
And then we had our head troll, not troll, but he was, troll for good, going on their websites and engaging them. Because our thought is, like, when you engage a troll or the disinformation, you know you're going to get slammed, right? But we're not doing it to win that argument with them. We're doing it because there's people that might be watching themselves. And so then they see us standing up to them and us can, throwing the links up and stuff like that. So that's kind of was part of two prompted.
With you, with your... I'm sure you don't have 100 people working for you doing investigative reporting. if you can do that and get on a very serious topic, because a lot of people died because of this, there's no fooling around.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I see that in the Inquirer? Why do I see that on CNN? Why do I see that on Fox? Why are we not getting that information
mm-hmm.
out there on what is going on? I imagine have more resources than you.
Oh, yeah. What do you think?
But you were able to find that out so easily. What's going on here?
What do you think?
Yeah. I think that perhaps they... Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to chime in, please do. I don't want to dominate
the conversation. We're kind of underwater here, so I don't know what... I don't understand what's going on. But they don't even want to hear from us. I know that much. If we gave it to them and said, hey, is this something you would like to print? Like, they're like, Like that, we don't. Our style sheets, our everything is not what they want.
Just talking about tips. Do you feel you're getting the information some of the articles that you want on important topics right now?
Honestly, I don't really think so. I think because everything is just so polarized right now that there's more or less just like two opinions on any certain topic, while that's just like not true. And this is just like generally speaking, I don't have like a specific issue in mind, but I definitely think because of that polarization, you see like these, like I kind of see like a divide between like the mainstream news organizations of, oh, do I want to hear this type of opinion on this issue, or do I want to hear that type of opinion? But I don't really get to see then, okay, well, how does this kind of tie into me locally? I feel like it's hard to find that viewpoint as well, because there's such a focus on national issues, national figures. But if it is an issue that, yes, if it is national, it is impacting on the local level, I feel like it's hard to find that story that would impact me the most.
Even locally, just to interject, my wife likes to watch local news in the morning, which I can't watch. And all it is there was a fire in Kensington. What the traffic is, which I don't need because I have Waze. What the weather is, which I don't have because I got the weather. What the sports are, because I don't need either. And some stupid local interest story of what's new at the Franklin Museum. You know, there's none of this. There's some serious issues going on locally, and they don't come. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, you're trying to make it happen, but you don't have the voice, and I'm trying to just figure out, like, Sheldon, do you feel you get any news that you want or you need?
Yeah, but not through mainstream sources. Like, I find a lot of my news on social media through sources, like, the people I follow, like, I vet their sources, but never through, like, your MSNBC, CBS, or, God forbid, Fox. But, yeah, but they're way too, like, politicized, like Eric said. It's either one or the other, and I find a lot of actual individual opinions through what are basically independent journalists.
What's your thoughts?
Like Eric was saying, everything is just, like, so polarized, and it's, like, one or the other, and I feel like local news tends to forget that, like, they can also report on their opinions about things and give, like, opinion of what their community might think of an instance, rather to just like, here's what mainstream is saying, here's all of this information, this instead, like, but they'll tend to report, like how you were saying, about like the most asinine things that don't affect people like daily.
The big story on local news is a horse on 95 running. I don't care. I really don't care unless I was on 95.
Yeah.
But I don't care about that. And it's just not just like going to Fox, for example. This is a perfect example. There was a poll done by historians on presidents.
Yes.
Their ranking. Trump, dead last. And the way they reported on Fox was that Trump didn't finish first. And yeah, that's true, but you know, so it's misinformation. But I just want to get to a more serious topic. We're talking about misinformation. The GOP has been very strong in trying to impeach Joe Biden. The main piece of evidence came from a guy named Smirnoff, who should have tipped him off, as we said earlier beforehand. And it turns out it came from a Russian source. The Russians are constantly planting misinformation in our media. We keep on grabbing it, like idiots grabbing onto the hook. We keep on grabbing the worm, even though we should know who's throwing it out there. We keep on taking it. How do you see yourselves in this, to provide information or to attack the information out there that's not being explored?
Right. Funny you should mention this. So we do print a lot of times. We'll put stuff on social media and allow the comments from people to filter through so people have an argument, and then we can print that. And then I think when people see the people having a conversation, that kind of helps get that across. What else would you say?
Well, the topic of using like local voices, like with the Corey thing. You know, we had the whole, I don't know if we spoke about that last time, but Corey's a reporter, a contributor of ours. and we wanted him to write something.
Wanted to write something.
He's Jewish. He wanted to write something about the Palestine-Israel conflict. So he was writing about the war and all that, who's right and who, you know, the blow-by-blow, I guess, in his view.
Right, and I'm fact-checking it and going like, I don't know, dude, that's not a valid source. We have to stay within these sources, so that's we're going to have to look. That video doesn't really tell us anything. We have to keep going back here.
So he, so we basically had to just spike the article because we couldn't come to an agreement on what we thought of was over there, and we're no Middle East experts in any way, so that was not a problem, but we did come to an understanding in the sense that we went down, we met with him, and we talked through things with him because obviously it was a very emotional issue for him. But what we came up with was he's had a lot of people turn their backs on him because of this conflict. And he's even almost been attacked walking his son to school because he was wearing a kippah. So we said, well, could you tell us that story? Could you talk to us about your personal experience? And I think that turns the whole thing around. It takes like a local lens or a personal lens and looks at the conversation through that. So seeing a larger issue like Palestine-Israel through a local person's lens.
And then I think modeling the literacy, right? So when the people have the conversation, we make sure we, it's like you walking through. Oh, this is true. No, that's not true. That's missing. Here's this. I think people like to be told when something is fake, when you point it out to them, because then they know, like, oh, well, now I'm not going to be fooled. So there's this, I don't know, USA Today, every day you get a newsletter for fake, you can sign up for fake news newsletters, and they're great, and they're from any. One of them might be NASA discovered a photograph of heaven. And then someone has the doctored image, and then you see that when, like, shared, shared, like, yeah, it's amazing, it's like a city. And they'll say, like, shared 17,000 times on Instagram, and then we'll bring that up, and we're working on with Corey. It's I wouldn't call it a podcast, but it's just like something we're doing on YouTube live when we get a chance. As we go through these things and we kind of like make fun of them, but also talk about them. Like there was one about Princess Di, and they took a photo of her from 1997, and it's been aged with AI, so it looks really real. Did you see that? She's back, and people are like, "Oh, I knew it all along," and they make fun. But then, like, what's the point of this? Like, why? Why does a Russian troll farm care to make the Princess Di look like she's back again? And I really think it's just to undermine truth, right? So anytime we can take the dumbest piece of misinformation and just show somebody or talk about it or have that conversation, I think it's important to be like, look what they're doing. Her face has been changed. Why? I don't know. But you know that something like 60% of all of the troll stuff is coming through women's wellness pages. That was a little of a, right? All the wellness people. So, you know, it started with the anti-vax, and now it's just gone crazy with, you know, G-fun and all that stuff. So.
You make a great point, though. It's as stupid as it may seem, these things. But what it does undermine truth. And once you start that, it's almost an infection. Mm-hmm. That when you start doubting, well, maybe that, if I believe that, maybe I'll believe this. And before you know it, you know, if you start with something ridiculous like flat earth or whatever. Yeah. But you continue to move forward until you get insecure enough.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can actually trace the way it goes. So why would Russia do it? Because they can't out-weapon us, and they can't out-fight us. They can out-information us, and we, for whatever reason, keep on taking the bait.
Well, it's often given with recipes. So they'll have, like, recipe, cute animal photo, happy little, you know, inspirational quote, and QAnon bullshit. And then, like, once again, and it's very subtle.
It's effective.
But then we kind of do that, you know. We'll put, like, happy hip-hop story, this. By the way, you know, something real hardcore unions or something like that. Like, we'll slide in our progressive ideas when we can because, I mean, it's for the people. So, you know, you're not going to see it in the mainstream, so we'll make it as palatable as possible.
I was going to say, it also makes it just, like, so much easier for, like, people to, like, digest the information, like, whether it be, like, real news or, like, misinformation. It just, if it's something heavier, it's having it sandwiched, like, the sandwich effect, it just makes it so much more palatable for anyone. Mm-hmm.
It does. And trains you, right? It's training us to be like, that recipe was delicious. So, like, this fact,
it has to be true.
Why could it not be? They made a great sandwich.
It also search engine optimizes it too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's true. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes it more findable in the results.
Mm-hmm. Forget that.
Mm-hmm. That comes from the library.
Listen to the librarians.
I have a lot to say, but I know someone.
No, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
With misinformation, we also have to acknowledge that information itself is privilege. Like, to have information, to have knowledge, is a privilege. Mm-hmm. So when we have these things, and when people are spreading misinformation, they're also taking away a certain type of privilege, and they're making other people feel like they have this illusion of privilege. Like, oh, I know this, you don't know this. It gives them an ego boost. It makes them feel good about themselves. And then when they're proven to be wrong, we've talked about this in conspiracy theories, but there's this cognitive dissonance, right? And they don't, it's like, this is what I believe is true, but you're telling me something else and I don't agree with that. So it's really hard because it puts stress on the body, you know? So it's like, when you spread information, when you're allowing this to happen, when all of this fake news is happening, you just kind of, you disenfranchise the people at a whole, and that's an advantage for people who do not like us, for people who want to underprivilege the people of America, or people in schools, or anything.
Okay, so I love that you mentioned information privilege, because I was going to talk about that. My name is Megan Donnelly, so I'm the Outreach and Engagement Librarian here at the Gutman Library. I teach information literacy, so I'm a teaching librarian. Information literacy is essentially the skill you use anytime you encounter information, whether you're looking at Google search results, you're doing a research paper, or you're deciding who to vote for. You use information literacy, yet it's not really something that is consistently taught in our K-12 or higher education curricula. And librarians, which are situated in a feminized profession, meaning it's one of the first jobs that women could work, are rarely, if ever, consulted about the weaving information literacy into the curricula. Mm-hmm. So New Jersey was actually the first state to mandate information literacy instruction in the K-12 curricula last year, in 2023.
That's great.
So essentially, our students are coming to us in higher education without information literacy skills, and we are assuming that they had the privilege of having a librarian at their school or a library, or that their parents taught them this information, which is rarely the case. So we're assuming a lot there, and then once they get here, teaching librarians are limited to one-shot instruction sessions. So that's the bane of our existence as teaching librarians across the country will write blogs about it, and how flawed that system is, but that's what we're limited to. So we go to a session for 70 minutes, and we try to meet a minimum of usually 3 learning objectives in that time. We use very advanced pedagogical methods. We've received so much training just so faculty will take us seriously, so we will get invited in for the one session. Rarely are we asked to like offer like curricular feedback about how information literacy is like scaffolded through the curricula. I was reading an article today about how social sciences undergraduate students and graduate students need to know data literacy, but how can you teach data literacy if there's no base level information literacy? So I think that is the true way, I mean, from my positionality as an academic teaching librarian, to make people more information literate. Another stat that I shared with the conspiracies class was that there are 7 certified librarians in the school district of Philadelphia for 125,000 students, which is the lowest ratio in the country. And there's a lack of access to resources that people need to be information literate, like laptops, Wi-Fi. There's digital redlining in Philadelphia. So there is not, you know, Wi-Fi reception or cell reception in certain places, so you also may not be able to use a hotspot. And just like spaces to study as well. So I think that's the real issue here. And Stanford had a really interesting study from 2017 about civic online reasoning. And their sample was huge. So they sampled 11th graders from across the United States, from every demographic you could probably think of, and showed them videos of ballot stuffing. And asked them if they thought it was true. And they all said yes. They didn't do lateral reading, they didn't evaluate the information that they were looking at, so essentially this huge everyone in this huge sample scored 0 on information literacy. So yeah, advocate for libraries, advocate for librarians. Libraries also buy information. We buy information. In an academic library, too, we even buy back the information that is published by the faculty at the institution, yet our budgets are cut because we're feminized. So we're constantly short-staffed, constantly not taken seriously. We have to deal with gender-based microaggressions all the time, all day long, every day. So it gets really tiring and burnout-y, but so I think information literacy is a key to solving those information.
What it is the fertile ground for implanting these things, because you're not taught the skills in high school, junior high school, whatever it may be, and that makes it a perfect opportunity for people to take advantage of us. So I totally agree with everything you said. Endorse that commercial brought to you by the Gutman Library. Totally endorse it. Anyone who's around has been fooled in our group by false information and found out later, and even acted on false information and found out later what happened to you. Any have any examples in your life? I did just one, okay, that I wasn't fooled. I did my lateral, but there is a old wise thing going around about Trump talking about how he thinks the Republican voters are idiots. Okay, and it's a quote. Now, when I got that, I said, yeah, I want to share that one, okay? But instead of doing that, I check it out. You go to Snopes, and you go, there's a number of places to go, and they say, no, he never said that. It's been going around, but he never said. There's also one with him in bed with his daughter, which who knows what happened in real life, but that picture is not true either. So what you have there, it's very easy to grab onto something that goes along with what you believe and then send it out there to the world. But every time you send something out to the world, you're endorsing it. You know, you're putting your name behind it and your credibility, and it's so easy to check it out. It really is not that hard, you know, because you have that thing called Google. You can very easily check a lot of things out. You know, Alex, you have a similar situation?
Yes, but also, like, how you were saying, like, it's really easy to check out information through Google. Something that, like we'd actually discussed in conspiracy theories is, like, it's so easy to find misinformation on Google as well, because you can just, anything that you search, you can twist the narrative and make it so easy to have a search that matches what you think. Mm-hmm. It'll be so fast. And even if you are actively trying to get new information that is correct, it's so, so simple for, like, one mistyped word or one, like, added phrase just to twist the entire narrative and have something that's completely different, and therefore feeding, like, a false narrative and continuing to spread that misinformation further and further.
Similar situation, but it wasn't me, it was my grandfather. So when Obama, I'm pretty sure it was when Obama first, like, got into office as president, he heard something about that Obama is having a deal with Walmart, that there's going to be, like, underground tunnels or something, and they're going to kill the people in Walmart and take them and just brutalize them and throw them in these underground tunnels. So one day he sat there and he went to Walmart and they were constructing the Walmart, like, there was construction going on. So he was freaking out thinking that this is what was happening, and he calls up my aunt and was like, "Ann, we're moving to Chile, we're moving to Chile." And then she was like, "What are you talking about?" She was like, "They're building underground tunnels, they're trying to kill us in Walmart." She was like, "Where did you hear that?" And then he was like, "Oh, friends at work, I saw this on this website, whatever, whatever." And this was in, like, 2008-ish. So he was going to move us, all of us, to Chile because of this. And it's simply because he did not decide to do background research. And it wasn't until his sister was like, "Hey, calm down. That's not what's happening. They're doing construction on that Walmart. Right. If you walk into it, you'll see that."
Right.
But it was because of that. And because he didn't have access to such information,
right,
he literally almost moved our entire family to a different country.
Right, but he depended on his sister.
Yes.
So you do, the people who are close to you can have some influence. So I guess that's why, again, when we're back to the local news, like, maybe people in your neighborhood might be able to make a little more headway when it comes to these things.
I think the generational element is also really interesting to pay attention to, and to think about, you know, the specific errors of each demographic, because I think like different demographics are going to make really distinctive kinds of mistakes. So I mean, like trusting the sources that you find on social media because they've been proven, you know, I've done this much research, therefore everything this particular source says is somebody that I'm going to listen to, and then versus, you know, my father-in-law, my mother, you know, the generation where they're, you know, you know, then don't go to New York to meet that gentleman's mother, please. You know, those kinds of conversations that unfortunately I've had. So, like, where that information is coming from and what you're trusting and who you're trusting, I think that these are all really interesting to pay attention to. And note that I didn't name check my own generation because obviously I know what I'm doing and I'm fine. but yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing. And those sort of like those points of ignorance, those points where you're not willing to maybe interrogate your own bias or your own, but you can see it in other groups very easily.
Yeah. It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Okay. No, go ahead.
I had a question about localism.
Yeah.
I could ask quite a few questions about localism because I'm very curious about what it is you're doing, what you think about localism. I think you pointed to some phenomena like gentrification, you pointed to some phenomena like local newspapers going out of business. I think those things are probably somewhat related, but there's other things going on too. Okay, what are my questions here? I find your branding curious if you're Northwest Philly, right? Because I think there was something online, maybe you have a URL that redirects to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're between, we're not really geographically based, it's just that we live here, so that explains why some of the stuff is ours.
Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm wondering, like, I don't know, maybe, and I think probably the easiest way to think about this is by talking about the needs of Philadelphia, what you think the needs are of informing people. You talked about gentrification. One of the things that's going on is that people are moving more because people, it's harder for people to buy houses now.
Sure.
And so people just, you know, keep moving because they, it's very annoying to move from a house you bought, but it's sometimes you get pushed out of places you're renting, right?
Sure.
Or you get priced out, or you...
But the resources leave, the work leaves, and the doctor you see leaves.
So you're dealing with all these things.
Sure.
Philadelphia is obviously a city that's changing very rapidly. What are your thoughts about what Philadelphia needs, and how you're trying to address what you think it is that Philadelphia needs?
That's a great question, and I actually think that it's interesting you say that, because the branding is weird. And because no, it's true. It's meant to be. It's, well, not exactly, but this is an experiment. So what we've done is like wherever we go, and for the last 10 years, like we've made connections here. What we want to do is we just put our hands out and say, "Give us what you got," right? And whoever in that neighborhood has stuff to give us, and sometimes they can't even if your person doesn't write and read, they can tell us that we will record them and then transcribe it. And then tell it back to them, be like, does this work for you? And work with people, right? So we're just here to grab every month whatever people want to talk about. And we have people who come back to us regularly, and sometimes we have months where we go out, like right here. This is something we're going to pull in. So this is something people want to talk about, right? You guys are people, I think. All of you. Yeah, okay. So very funny. So this is going to be something. So right now it's just kind of like if you can imagine like old school Facebook page, like a neighborhood Facebook group, but it's for Philadelphia, and people just posting, right? And it would be great if we had more reach, right? So you get even more granular stories from all over and more weird stories. But the idea right now is it's kind of evolving. And in the beginning, it was a lot of just fluffy stuff. It was a lot of traffic. People love to talk about traffic. Dog poop. Oh, my God. We no more dog poop articles. But then there was a flurry of people wanting to talk about race stuff during George Floyd. There was a lot of that. So we had Dr. Woodson, a guy from Germantown, who was writing for us, and he would write these articles that were just very like whoa, blah, blah, blah. But they fact checked. I would fact check for him and make sure that some of the stuff that he said didn't make any sense. But some of it was like I did not even know that. And when I fact checked and I followed that source, I was like, okay, you get this is good. So that went away after George Floyd kind of went fade away. Now nobody's wearing the Black Lives Matter thing has kind of subsided. And now I guess what's our next thing? What has come up since then? I guess
I mean, with the big name.
What are now with Lorenzo in a way? So who's our person now? Where's the tone going now? I guess it's misinformation. Actually, we have a lot of stuff about misinformation, disinformation.
And
people want to talk about it.
Right. And the thing is, I mean, we do tell stories through, again, the local lens, but we think people have these kind of issues across the city.
Oh, immigration came up, right?
We've got the Friends
Peace Sanctuary. That's what's happened. I think if we've replaced the George Floyd kind of stuff with immigration, but that's how the issues just kind of bubble up organically, and we kind of let the paper change, and we're kind of trying to see what.
Yeah,
we have as you can see, a very big poster.
Yeah, I'm looking at that.
We're going to have the Davis Rhetoric of Politics, and what the misinformation, which we've been talking about, is not only leading to a poor education, but it's also leading to violence.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have synagogues that have been attacked. Asian people were attacked with certain someone I won't mention called it the Chinese flu. You have Muslims, of course, have been attacked.
300%, I think. Like, it's ridiculous. The hate crimes are going up.
The anti-Semitism, racism, anti-Muslim, anti-women, all this is getting so accelerated by all this that this is just not an academic question we're having, but it could be January 6th based upon our survival as a nation. So how do you... I know you're educating us here and what you're trying to do. What should we be doing in order? I know we have the librarian. It's a great idea.
What should we be doing? Come on, yeah.
This is some serious stuff.
It is.
So how do we, in the last little minutes, how do we fight this?
So I would say the very first thing is by getting librarians involved in the curricula. We try so hard to build one-way relationships all the time. We do so much extensive training for building relationships in the community. We reach out to people every semester. I have a spreadsheet of tracking how many people I reach out to, when I reach out to them, what I say to them, and everything. And it's so rare that people ever reach out to us and invite us into somewhere unless we have like a very strong, like long-standing relationship with them. So I urge you, if you're an educator, to invite librarians in to provide curricular consultation on the involving information literacy in the curricula and scaffolding research assignments and creating, you know, memorable evidence-based in science learning experiences for students, as well as assignments and assessments of that. So that's what I recommend. I recommend advocating for libraries and librarians as a means to stop the misinformation. And definitely within the School District of Philadelphia too, they like definitely need more librarians. We need more librarians here too. We have, you know, frozen positions and stuff. So.
Anybody else have any ideas what they want to do? Just seeing around how you walk away. Eric, you get a heavy sigh, so I'll help you.
I think just how I'm picturing it right now is I don't think I have a clear set plan on what I should do. I think it's a really like case by case basis on how to like tackle this issue. Because I mean, I don't have like a list of like sources or things that I want to look into. So what to look out for. I know like the rhetoric and how to and manage that on my own, but to do this more large scale, I think it's just a case by case basis, and I'll just have to see really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, for us, if there's anyone who would like to contribute anything to the paper, if anyone has some thoughts,
right.
What's
looking
to do?
For the drip. Right. Every edition, if we can put something in about it, or
particularly younger voices.
Right.
We have older folk in a lot of cases, but younger voices are underrepresented in the newspaper.
Right.
So you guys are sort of on the front lines with the social media and all that.
Right. And the George Santos article that we wrote is our attempt to make it fun, because I know when you say like, "Hey, let's get everybody together and talk about data and literacy and media literacy," people's eyes might glaze over, and sometimes. I don't know, like we're always trying to find short bites of information, colorful bites of information. You don't have to tell them everything at once, but maybe just making it a regular part of every article or every edition. I don't know, maybe you and I need to have more of these conversations to figure out how to use the paper platform to fight digital misinformation.
Yeah, so what she's referring to, and sure we can't see that on Radio Land, but yeah, it's our Summoning Santos article, and basically is sort of written tongue-in-cheek in the beginning of it, and talking about how he really is what we call a thought form, that is really sort of a reflection of our issues, the lies in public discourse, and the polarization, and the anger that comes with it, and it sort of it created him, basically. But at the end, on the second page, we have a chart, a media chart that just shows you left to center to right for all of the news organizations, the major ones anyway.
That's a small one.
And we also talk about the Pro-Truth Pledge, which is based on a book by Dr. Gleb Sapirsky and Tim Ward called Pro-Truth, A Practical Plan for Putting Truth Back into Politics. You can go to the protruthpledge.org site, and that has basically a disinformation action hub. So it gives you lots of information about how to do your lateral research and do all those things, which you know you're familiar with already. But if there's somebody who doesn't know about this and you can pass that along, that's great. But again, this article with Santos is started off as kind of like a, you know, not a the tongue-in-cheek almost. But at the end, it gives you important information that you can use.
It shows you one thing. Santos, to me, represents something very important we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little older than most of the people. I remember when telling a lie was something to be ashamed of.
Right.
And now, because we get so much, we've come almost, so what? I mean, somebody like Santos, 40 years ago, would have been laughed out of Congress the first day.
Yep.
Okay? But yet he was allowed to stay. All those times until the money of the party
mm-hmm.
finally came up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have gotten used to it to the point that we tolerate it. And when we're caught lying, instead of admitting it and having shame, we double down.
Yeah.
And that's what when we talked about earlier, that's what struck me about one little lie or one little silly story about
mm-hmm.
it has led to us being immune from the shame of lies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we have to you know, we have to get that back.
Amen.
We have to reclaim reality
yeah.
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was laughed out. He was literally laughed out of Congress.
Eventually. Not the first day, Bryce.
Yeah.
Pretty soon, you know, I don't know.
When he said he was a volleyball star and he wasn't out on that alone
right.
should have
right,
happened.
Right. Wasn't it after he was taking money, he was calling
yeah.
people and saying that he was for somebody else and then that.
Yeah, that's where he started taking. It's just the money matters.
Yeah.
So I think there are consequences, but I think there's no shame in him. But
mm-hmm.
he's one individual person, right? So I think you don't want to. He's not our culture. He is something that's happening in our culture. But I think that you know, I think that people do face consequences.
I
still.
Hope you're right.
I always think about like the Howard Dean line. You know what I mean? Is it more ridiculous than going yeehaw in a public space and having your entire
right.
campaign collapse?
Right, because you're
right.
like yeehaw.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Saying something ridiculous, like just a moment of exuberance
right.
compared
so you all can look
to
out,
the various.
You all can
things.
Look
yeah.
up Howard Dean
yeah.
later.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, who the heck is this?
It happened
the
many years
ago.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it'd be a good time to end on a good note. I really want to thank you so much for coming here and presenting this much-needed conversation, which needs to go out there and more librarians, especially
yes.
in the
yes.
Yes.
more lateral research,
yes.
more
yes.
local newspapers,
yes.
more fact-checking, as you put it, Joe,
yeah.
and
yeah.
just more getting. More intelligence would be nice.
Yeah.
Thank
well, it's
so
like,
much.
You're welcome. Thank you for
thank
having
you.
Us. And it really is, something, like you said, you used to take for granted, now you sort of have to work at it. It's like building a muscle.
Yeah.
So.
There
you
go. All right. Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you guys for talking about misinformation in the media. It's so important for us to keep talking about these issues, to change society's normal, and to further inform and educate others about it. Thank you to Stephen Fillmore and Carolyn Sullivan for hosting this event. And again, we post our roundtables on our YouTube and SoundCloud, and we are broadcasted on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on G-Town Radio, 92.5 FM, WGGT. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Yay.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.